I guess that I'd gone far enough when we began to use the computer to illustrate the divine decrees. My knowledge of a computer is limited to about 50 bytes max, but we forged forward and have used that as an example and an illustration. I wanted to offer another idea, another teaching aid, if you will, that comes from the field of computer technology that is presently a cutting-edge type of development. Progress on this changes almost daily. And I want to introduce it as a way to visualize what is occurring with George Bailey as he enters into what is now known as Pottersville. And we want to take a moment to define the concept of immersive virtual reality. Now, beginning at the scene of his accident, remember George crashed his car into a tree in front of a fellow's house. And he has told Clarence he wants to go back up and get his car and drive back up to Martini's and get a good stiff drink. And beginning with the scene of the accident and later at the bar, which turns out to be Nick's bar, George enters into what may be described in the language of the 1990s, a term called immersive virtual reality. Now, we've used the computer and its vocabulary to illustrate the doctrine of divine decrees. We will now use a relatively new computer technology called virtual reality to illustrate the experiences of George Bailey as he moves through a world in which he never existed. In that virtual world, he knows almost all the people he encounters, while he is but a rank stranger to them. Now, I want to define virtual reality, but before I get involved in it, let me give you the little bit that I understand about it. There is a device that you can wear on your head. It is called a head-mounted display. And when you put this helmet-like device on, what you see is a virtual world. But as you turn your head and as you move about, there is the concept of moving about within that virtual world. You can walk around items. You can see certain subjects and certain objects from different perspectives. They become larger as you advance toward them and smaller as you move away. And this is all imagery that is fed into this device by computer technology. And that is called a virtual world or virtual reality. And the concept of immersive is that you, when you're wearing this device, are immersed into that virtual environment. So here that's the idea. Here are some definitions of all of that. The term virtual reality was initially coined in 1989 by Jaron Lanier, who is the founder of the Virtual Reality Laboratory at the University of Michigan. It is a research facility within the College of Engineering, and it is operated by the Department of Naval Architecture and Marine Engineering. Other related terms include artificial reality, developed by Myron Kruger in the 1970s, cyberspace, coined by William Gibson in 1984, and more recently, virtual worlds and virtual environments, developed in the 1990s. Now, originally, the term referred to immersive virtual reality. In immersive VR, the user becomes fully immersed in an artificial, three-dimensional world that is completely generated by a computer. The head-mounted display was the first device providing its wearer with this immersive experience. It presents a stereo view of a virtual world. A motion tracker continuously measures the position and orientation of the user's head and then allows the image-generating computer to adjust the scene representation to the current view. As a result, the viewer can look around and walk through the surrounding virtual environment. Now, as you do this, there is the mental concept that you are where you aren't. You move through a visual arena and you are immersed in it, you can walk up to certain items or subjects, things that are in the computer, and you can examine them from different angles as you walk around and through this virtual environment. A variety of input devices assist this. For example, data gloves, joysticks, and handheld wands allow the user to navigate through a virtual environment and to interact with virtual objects. The unique characteristics of immersive virtual reality include the following. First of all, the ability to navigate in three-dimensional space and allow for look around, walk around, and fly through capabilities in virtual environments. Mike Probasco has developed a system at Boeing that enables F-15 pilots to learn how to fly the aircraft in a simulated environment. He is presently in the Middle East. I think he's at an air show in Bahrain today, and then he will be in Saudi Arabia for a while. But I could not consult him on this. But apparently there is the possibility in the future, if it's not currently true, for fighter pilots to learn how to fly their aircraft in a virtual environment, and that would be part of their training, and they would not have to get in the aircraft to continue their training. I'll have to talk with him about that when he gets back. But there is this concept in virtual reality where you can look around, walk around, and fly around in this virtual environment. Stereoscopic viewing that enhances the perception of depth and a sense of space is an advantage. There's a 3D environment. You feel as if you are immersed, as it were, in this environment. A third concept, presentation of a virtual world in full scale, relates properly to the human size. All of the objects that you view are the proper size, and you feel as though you are actually in that environment. Realistic interactions with virtual objects by means of data glove and similar devices allow for manipulation of these virtual objects, operation of them, and control of the virtual world in which you are immersed. And finally, the convincing illusion of being fully immersed in an artificial world that can also be enhanced by auditory, touch, and other non-visual technologies. So as the technology here advances and as the cutting edge moves forward, you will be able to enter into one of these virtual worlds by wearing the proper devices and literally feel as if you are in another place and even at another time. Now, the applications of virtual reality are virtually unlimited. A virtual environment can represent any three-dimensional world that is either real or abstract. This includes real systems like buildings, landscapes, underwater shipwrecks, spacecrafts, archaeological excavation sites, human anatomy, sculptures, crime scene reconstructions, solar systems, and so on. Of special interest is the visual and sensual representation of abstract systems like magnetic fields, turbulent flow structures, molecular models, mathematical systems, auditorium acoustics. Now that's a phenomenal concept, to use virtual reality to somehow be able to see how sound reverberates off walls in a given auditorium. Then you can come in with proper acoustics and know precisely where to put what device. Stock market behavior can be tracked, population densities, information flows, many other conceivable systems, including artistic and creative work of an abstract nature. Now, useful applications of virtual reality include training in a variety of areas. For example, the military, medicine, equipment operation. You can learn how to operate a piece of equipment in a virtual world without the fear of chopping your hand off or squashing your head, whatever the situation happens to be. In the military, you can learn certain tactics, certain operations, certain procedures in a virtual world. In medicine, you can operate on someone and not kill the subject, even if you do. in education, in design evaluation, architectural walkthroughs. Can you imagine building a building and go into a virtual world and escort your customers through the building, pointing out various aspects of the construction progress so that they can see what's going on? They can make suggestions, give approval, or what have you, but not have to expose them to the dangers of the literal environment where the construction is going on. There are ergonomic studies that are conducted in this way, and obviously there's a big market in the entertainment field utilizing immersive virtual reality. Now, this information and much more on the subject of virtual reality is available by logging on to the internet, accessing the website of the Virtual Reality Laboratory, www.vrl.umich.edu. And that's a part of the website of the University of Michigan. Now, the reason I gave you that little tidbit, it took less than 10 minutes, is so that you might use that as an idea to evaluate what's going on with George Bailey. He's been placed into a virtual world. It appears real to him. All of the people there are those he knows, and he can interact with them. He can walk around them. He can touch them, speak with them. But in the end, it's going to turn out not to be true at all. He was involved and he was immersed into a virtual world. Now we're ready to take a tour of that virtual world. Paragraph C, Pottersville, a town without historical impact. After George and Clarence leave the toll housekeeper's office, their first stop is the residence in front of which George smashed his car into a tree. Clarence, as he observes George moving about this huge tree in dismay. What's the matter? Well, this is where I left my car, and it isn't here. You have no car. Well, I had a car, and it was right here. I guess somebody moved it. Then a fellow arrives carrying Christmas packages, apparently the owner of the home. He says, good evening. And George says, hey, say, where's my car? I beg your pardon. My car. I'm the fellow who owns the car that ran into your tree. What tree? What do you mean, what tree? This tree. I ran into it, cut a big gash in the side here. And so the homeowner hurriedly goes over and looks at his tree, and he finds no gash. And then he stands up and leans forward and smells George's breath. He says, you must mean two other trees. You had me worried. This is one of the oldest trees in Pottersville. Pottersville? You mean Bedford Falls. I mean Pottersville. Don't you think I know where I live? What's the matter with you? Then he walks away. And George shakes his head and he says, I don't know. Either I'm off my nut or he is. Then he looks at Clarence and says, or you are. 'Tisn't me. Well, maybe I left my car up at Martini's. Well, come on, Gabriel. Clarence. The next scene reveals George and Clarence seated at the bar of what was formerly Martini's, but what is now known as Nick's. As Nick, the bartender, comes over to take their order, George asks him, hi, Nick, where's Martini? You want a martini? No, Martini, your boss, where is he? Hey, look, I'm the boss. You want a drink or don't you? Okay, double bourbon, will you, and quick. And as Nick turns away, he says, wow, what's the matter with him? I never saw Nick act like that before. Clarence says, you'll see a lot of strange things from now on. Hey, little fellow, you worry me. You got some place to sleep? Nope. You don't, huh? Got any money? Nope. No wonder you jumped in that river. I jumped in the river to save you so I could get my wings. At which moment, the cash register rings up a sale, and Clarence says, uh-oh, somebody just made it. George says, made what? And before he can answer, Nick returns to overhear Clarence say, every time you hear a bell ring, it means that some angel just got his wings. And then under his breath, looking at Nick, scrunches face up, George says, look, I think maybe you better not mention getting your wings around here. Why? Don't they believe in angels? Yeah, they believe. Well, then why should they be surprised when they see one? Then feeling Nick needs an explanation, George says, he never grew up. How old are you anyhow, Clarence? 293 next May. That does it, says Nick. Out you two pixies go, through the door or out the window. I had to look up the word pixie. I had no idea what a pixie was. I thought, why did he say pixie? Fairy is the definition. That's Webster's ninth. If that's politically incorrect, talk to Webster's. George, Nick, what's wrong? Nick, now there's another thing. What do you come off calling me Nick? Well, Nick, that's your name. What's that got to do with it? I don't know you from Adam's off ox. And at this point, Emil Gower enters Nick's bar. He's the druggist for whom George worked as a boy and whose career and reputation was saved by young George's heroics regarding a poisonous prescription Mr. Gower erroneously filled for a sick child in Bedford Falls. And as you recall, Mr. Gower's son died suddenly of influenza, and in a state of depression, the pharmacist mistakenly filled a prescription with poisonous pills and asked George to deliver it. Knowing of the error, George sought ways to inform Mr. Gower of the mistake, but to no avail. Ultimately, George refused to deliver the poisonous pills to the child's family, and as a result was severely beaten by the distraught Mr. Gower. George immediately used biblical problem-solving devices to manage the situation, won Mr. Gower's apology, and swore to protect him from his mistake by never mentioning the incident to anyone. George kept that promise, and Mr. Gower maintained his job and his reputation. They remained friends from then on. Now, as a disheveled, bewildered, and broken old man, Mr. Gower enters the door of Nick's bar. He is in obvious poverty, suspect health, and apparently drunk. His presence gets Nick's immediate attention, and he says to him, "Hey, Rummy, come over here. Didn't I tell you not to come panhandling around here, huh?" And he picks up one of those little bottles they have in bars that squirt to water or what have you down into a glass. But he holds it up and squirts it right into Mr. Gower's face. And everybody dies laughing. George says, Mr. Gower, what? Mr. Gower, this is George Bailey. Don't you know me? And Gower says, No. Patron says, just throw him out. But George says, Nick, isn't that Mr. Gower, the druggist? You know, that's another reason for me not to like you. That rum head spent 20 years in jail for poisoning a kid. If you know him, you must be a jailbird too. And then he motions to the bouncer, "Would you show these gentlemen to the door?" He says, "Sure, this way, gentlemen." And he throws George and Clarence out the front door into the snow. And as they lie there on the ground, Clarence says to George, "You see, George, you were not there to stop Gower from putting the poison into the capsules." "What do you mean I wasn't there?" "I remember distinctly. Four principles. Principle number one, the decree of God is His eternal and immutable will regarding the future existence of events which will happen in time and regarding the precise order and manner of their occurrence. George's involvement in discovering the mistake made by Mr. Gower was a part of that principle. The decree of God in His eternal and immutable will regarding the future existence of events that will happen in time and regarding the precise order and manner of their occurrence. Everything we do is in the decrees, and all actions are interwoven and they are interdependent. Principle number two, in eternity past, divine sovereignty established that certain things would actually come into being while other things would not. Divine sovereignty decreed that George Bailey would come into being and his thoughts, decisions, and actions were part of the overall scheme of things. And so the mistake was made, but the boy's life was protected by George Bailey's presence in the decrees. In eternity past, divine sovereignty established that certain things would actually come into being. Mr. Gower's mistake, while other things would not. The boy would not die. George Bailey was important in the decrees in order to make that a certain reality. Principle number 3. Many things that occur are the result of angelic or human free will acting contrary to God's desires. It was not God's desire that the death of one young man, Mr. Gower's son, would influence the death of another, the young man who was about to be poisoned. Many things that occur are the result of angelic or human free will acting contrary to God's desires. Mr. Gower made poor decisions from weakness created by his distraught mental attitude over his son's sudden death. Nevertheless, principle number 4, God decided or willed that these things would take place, thus he makes our volition truly free. George's volition was free to make good decisions from a position of strength. It was extremely important. In fact, it was critical that George Bailey be born, that he grow up, that he make thoughts, decisions, and actions that contributed to the inner workings and interplay, the interdependency of all things that occur in Bedford Falls and elsewhere. George Bailey's life, then, is a part of the perfect plan of God regarding human history, so that what he now observes as virtual reality did not occur historically. His life is part of the perfect plan of God. Human history, therefore, is dependent upon this one thing, this minor detail, this birth of one person and his subsequent life for the integrity of the whole. And therefore, you can visualize what he is now experiencing as him being placed, being immersed into a virtual world. The way God prevented this potential from becoming a reality was by his sovereign decision to select George Bailey. And he did that, he imputed him soul life, thus creating human life. And when that soul was imputed, it contained a volition that was truly free. And George Bailey used his free will to make good decisions that influenced others positively in Bedford Falls. So God prevented this potential, the concept of George Bailey never existing. He prevented that potential from becoming a reality when he selected George Bailey at physical birth. You are here, you are alive, you were selected. You therefore were known to God in eternity past. He has a reason and a purpose for your life. You therefore may be motivated by that concept. You have been given problem-solving devices to manage any exigency you face. If you choose to use them, then you can move forward in the objective of being a good witness for Jesus Christ in the appeal trial of Satan. You therefore can glorify God and magnify His Word. You can be blessed by Him and have invisible historical impact. The exigencies you face, the difficulties you encounter, are simply opportunities to be distracted, but they should not get your eyes focused away from your primary objective, and that is to learn Bible doctrine and thus organize your thinking. Everyone is important. Your life has meaning, purpose, and definition, and you need never be discouraged. Therefore, confidence and courage is the issue. Confidence from the Word of God gives courage toward life and circumstances. And so the way God prevented this potential from becoming a reality was by His sovereign decision to select George Bailey with human life and provide him with a volition that was truly free. George Bailey, by using his own free will, had invisible historical impact on his wife, children, family, fellow citizens, and community. As George gets up out of the snow, he notices that the sign over the building no longer reads Martini's Tavern, but simply Nick's. Hey, what's going on here? This ought to be Martini's place. He looks at Clarence and says, "Look, who are you?" "I told you, George, I'm your guardian angel." "Yeah, yeah, I know you told me that, but what else are you? Are you a hypnotist?" "No." "And why am I seeing all these strange things?" "Don't you understand, George, it's because you were not born." "Well, if I wasn't born, who am I?" "You're nobody. You have no identity." "Well, what do you mean, no identity? My name is George Bailey." "There is no George Bailey." And as George searches in his wallet, for his wallet and can't find it, Clarence goes on to tell him ahead of time, "You have no papers, no cards, no driver's license, no 4F card, no insurance policy." And then George decides he's got him, he got a coup de grace, and he shoves his fingers down in his watch pocket, and Clarence beats him to the draw, and he says, "They're not there either." "What?" "Zuzu's petals." Blocklick statement number 2. "You've been given a great gift, George, a chance to see what the world would be like without you." He told him at the toll housekeeper's office, "You don't exist. You were never born." That is George's introduction to non-reality. At that point, George should have oriented but didn't. Now he has gone through the episode in front of the man's home, and now he's been thrown out of Nick's bar, and all of these people he claims he knows don't know him. He's a rank stranger as far as they're concerned. And out there, standing out in the cold and in the snow, he can't even find his own identity. "You've been given a great gift, George, a chance to see what the world would be like without you." What would happen if one of us was taken out of human history? Just subtracted. What would the impact be? Well, let's note 4 principles from the divine decrees. Number 1, to the degree that a believer makes application of doctrine to life, to that degree he has historical impact. To the degree that you make application of doctrine to life, to that degree you have historical impact. Have you ever applied doctrine to your life? If you didn't exist, that would be subtracted. Principle number 2. Doctrines applied to life accumulate and eventually have positive consequences in the believer's life. Positive consequences in the believer's life. Also impact on others. Subtract that from the divine decrees, and there is no accumulation of divine thought by you as an individual. And therefore, there are no positive consequences on your life or others associated with you. Principle number 3. Every time the believer applies doctrine to his life, it becomes a part of the indivisible system of things which are essential to the integrity of the whole. The entire plan of God is altered, critically altered, by the subtraction of one event. And that one event could be your physical birth. It would tragically and actually alter to a degree that it would be tragically flawed if you had not been born. You're part of the royal family of God. God has left you here for a purpose. There is great reason to move forward with wonderful hopes, ambitions, and with a concept of gratitude and appreciation for the opportunity. Every time the believer applies doctrine to his life, it becomes a part of the indivisible system of things which are essential to the integrity of the whole. And principle number 4, a believer's decisions have impact on his life, the lives of others, and on history in general. Subtract one person from the equation, and there has been a tragic subtraction to the entire system. George is standing there and has just been told by Clarence, "You've been given a great gift, George, a chance to see what the world would be like without you." And George says, "Wait a minute. This is some sort of funny dream I'm having here. So long, mister, I'm going home." "Home? You have no home. Oh, shut up. Cut it out. You're crazy. That's what I think. You're screwy. You're driving me crazy too. I'm seeing things here. I'm going home to see my wife and family. You understand that? I'm going home and I'm going alone. And he walks away. And Clarence, looking heavenward, says, "How am I doing, Joseph?" George has become immersed into what, for him at least, is a virtual world. He is able to walk around in a three-dimensional town, interact with its people, and observe a zeitgeist that appears real, but is the exact opposite of what he's known his entire life. That is virtual world for him. He sees people he knows. He can walk around inside this environment, talk with them, have exchanges, but the entire tone and mood of everything has changed. They don't know him. He can't communicate with them. And the city is entirely different, although he knows where everything is supposed to be. And he's walking around. Environment. But in the drama, what he is experiencing is not virtual reality, but a portion of potential human history that has been converted into reality by divine sovereignty, divine omnipotence, as well as divine omniscience. Omniscience knows all that is knowable, including that which is potential. And if a potential became reality, that potential being George's non-birth, then suddenly inserted into reality is the absence of George Bailey. God is sovereign. He has the ultimate volition of the universe and can make any decision he wants to, short of compromising his integrity. And we've studied how this most definitely would compromise his integrity, but through dramatic license, through his sovereignty and his omnipotence, the power to do it, he alters the divine decrees in order to show George Bailey what life would be like if he had never existed. George, then, is observing life in Pottersville, nay, Bedford Falls, as a result of having never been born. As he leaves Clarence in front of Nick's bar and walks toward Main Street, the changes become even more stark and staggering. George's experiences at the scene of his automobile wreck and at Nick's bar were mild compared to the intensified levels of virtual reality he encounters once he arrives at Main Street. There he confronts a community that is in an inversion, a city that he knew quite differently only a few hours before. Inversion is a phenomenal thing. Now, the inversion occurred here instantaneously. In the first session, we spoke of an inversion that takes several generations and sometimes many decades and even a century to transform a society from one that is based on traditional values to one that is chaotic and disrupted by human viewpoint and evil. That is a transition called inversion of a society, and it is going on in our client nation, and it is going down, not up. This occurred instantaneously when George Bailey was subtracted from the divine decrees. And his first clue, remember, the homeowner told him he lived in Pottersville. And George said, "You mean Bedford Falls?" He said, "No, Pottersville. I know where I live. What's the matter with you?" Well, as he gets to Main Street, downtown area, the sign that once read, "You are now in Bedford Falls," now reads, "Welcome to Pottersville." And as George begins his walk through downtown, he sees a city dominated by nightclubs. That's the real mother lode in Pottersville. All up and down Main Street, 24 hours a day, liquor, hostesses, gambling, making money hand over fist. Establishments known as the Blue Moon Bar, the Midnight Club, the Bamboo Room, the Burlesque Theater, the Indian Club, and the Dime a Dance Club dominate the scene. Other businesses include a bowling alley that advertises fights every Wednesday night, a pawnbroker, and the Pottersville Hotel. The Bailey Building and Loan was once over what is now the Dime a Dance Club. George asked a policeman where the Building and Loan moved and is told it went out of business years ago. As George talks with the policeman, Violet Bick is being arrested for some reason. I'm suspecting prostitution, and put into a paddy wagon. Confused by all this, George resolves to go home. He sees a cabbie, Ernie Bishop, drive by and hails him down. "Ernie, hey Ernie, take me home. I'm off my nut." "Where do you live?" "Now, doggone it, Ernie, don't you start pulling that stuff. You know where I live. 320 Sycamore. "All right, get in. 320 Sycamore. Now, Ernie, straighten me out here. Look, I've gotten into some bad liquor or something. Now, listen to me. Now, you're Ernie Bishop, and you live in Bailey Park with your wife and kid. Now, isn't that right?" "You seen my wife?" "Seen your wife? I've been to your house 100 times. "Look, bud, what's the idea? I live in a shack in Potter's Field. My wife left 3 years ago and took the kid, and I ain't never seen you before in my life, see?" "Okay, well, just step on it. Just step on it and get me home." And as Ernie drives past the burlesque theater, he spots Bert the policeman out front. He indicates that his passenger is, as George would put it, off his nut. And with that, Ernie gets into his squad car and follows Ernie's cab. As they arrive at 320 Sycamore, Ernie asks, "Is this the place?" "Of course it's the place." 320 Sycamore is an eyesore. It is rotting and crumbling in upon itself. And as George runs into what remains of his house, Bert drives up. "What's up, Ernie?" "I don't know, but we better keep our eye on this guy. He's bats." And inside, George runs through a decayed interior cluttered with cobwebs and debris, shouting for Mary and the kids. And suddenly Clarence reappears. "They're not here, George. You have no children." "Where are they? And what have you done with them?" "Bert." "All right, put up your hands. No fast moves. Come out here, both of you." "Bert, thank heaven you're here. What's happened to this house? Where's Mary? What's happened to my kids?" Ernie says, "You better watch him, Bert." "What's the matter here? Bert, Ernie, what's the matter with you two guys? You were both here on my wedding night. You both stood out there on the porch and sung to us. Don't you remember?" Ernie says, "I think I better get going." Bert says, "Look, why don't you be a good kid? We'll take you into a doctor. Everything's going to be all right. Now, come on." And George says, "Bert, now listen to me. Ernie, will you take me to my mother's house? Bert, listen, it's not me. It's that fellow there," as he points to Clarence. "He's trying to hypnotize me." Bert grabs his gun and says, "I hate to do this, but..." And Bert raises his gun and starts to buffalo George. But before he can, Clarence grabs his arm, bites his hand, and hollers, "Run, George! Run, George!" And George breaks free and runs away as Bert struggles on the ground with Clarence. As he tries to put handcuffs on him, Clarence screams for Joseph to help him. Suddenly, Clarence disappears, leaving Bert grasping at thin air. George runs all the way to his mother's house and rings the bell. As he waits, he sees a sign on the porch, "Ma Bailey's Boarding House." No vacancy posted underneath. As he turns around, he sees his mother at the door. However, she's not the charming, elegant lady as before, but rather a dark, hardened woman with a scowl on her face. "Well, Mother." "Mother? What do you want?" "Mother, it's George. I thought sure you'd remember me." "George who?" "If you're looking for a room, there's no vacancy." Mother, listen, please help me. Something terrible's happened to me. I don't know what it is. Something's happened to everybody. Please, let me come in and keep me here until I get over it." "Get over what? I don't take in strangers unless they're sent by somebody I know." "Well, I know everybody you know, like your brother-in-law, Uncle Billy." "You know him?" "Well, sure I do." When'd you see him last?" "Well, today at his house." "It's a lie." He's been in the insane asylum ever since he lost his business. And if you ask me, that's where you belong. And with that, she slams the door right in his face. George runs off the porch out to the street where Clarence, leaning against the mailbox, patiently awaits him. And Clarence says, Blocklick statement number 3, "Strange, isn't it? Each man's life touches so many others' lives. But when he isn't around, he leaves an awful hole, doesn't he?" It's here that we will pick up our study on Tuesday, for Clarence has some observations, and observations we've made amplify Clarence's third statement. Eventually, we'll note all four and draw some principles from the doctrine of divine decrees from them. But to this moment, George has yet to realize he doesn't exist. And Clarence is again trying to drive the point home that his life is very important. Strange, isn't it? Each man's life touches so many others' lives. But when he isn't around, he leaves an awful hole, doesn't he? Heavenly Father, we're grateful to you for the power of the Word. We thank you for this illustration that assists us in amplifying its concepts and thus building within our own souls concepts of spiritual self-esteem and a personal sense of destiny. Motivate and encourage us as we continue our pursuit of truth, and we lift our prayer in the name of Christ our Savior. Charis human kai reine, plethun thae en epinosai tu theu kai iesu tu kuriu hemon. And now may grace and prosperity be multiplied unto you by means of your knowledge of God and of Jesus our Lord. Amen. Guide me, O thy great Jehovah, shall we stand as we sing.